laying on his back for the next 10 years. Okay, I'm going to be talking about what that is here just in a few minutes, but before we do, let's see, did the bell ring? Okay. I've got a few more things to say about Persia. We were talking about the nation of Persia, and basically what we were talking about is the fall of Persia. Beautiful. Came out excellent. Thank you, brother. Boy, we'll make more use of you a little bit later on. That's really good. I really appreciate all that help. It's really good. Okay, so we're talking about Persia, and the last thing we really were talking about is the fall of Persia. We mentioned some of their kings and what happened to them, and we mentioned the fact that finally in 331, Persia fell after a period of 200 years of existence. They were defeated by the king whose name was Alexander the Great, which we'll talk about a little bit later on, and he defeated a king called Darius III in northern Mesopotamia at the Battle of Arbela, is the official historical title of that battle. But it was from Arbela that Alexander then advanced to the various Persian capitals, and they had several of them. He marched to Susa and Persepolis and Ecbatana, and there he seized the fabulous treasures of those cities. In fact, at Persepolis alone, there was so much treasure in the city of Persepolis that it took 10,000 pairs of mules and 5,000 camels just to carry away the loot, just to carry away the treasures in one city alone. That's how much there was there as far as treasures. And meanwhile, Darius III was murdered a short time later by his cousins, and with the death of Darius III, the Persian Empire collapses in the dust, and the Grecian Empire, which we're going to look at later on, comes to the forefront. Now, there are four important Persian cities that I'll mention briefly. I'm not going to take the time to say hardly anything about them, though, just to mention them. The first one is called Ecbatana. Which is also known as Hamadan. Ecbatana, and that's spelled Ecbatana. Ecbatana, it was located high in the Zagros Mountains. If you remember from your study of the lands of the Bible, the Zagros Mountains are right along the Tigris River. But it was a city located high up there in the mountains. And it was actually the summer palace of Cyrus the Great. But it was too cold to live there in the wintertime for permanent residence. So he lived there only a portion of the year. Of course, they weren't able to heat their buildings like we are today. And so in the northeast section of the city, there is what is called the Cliff Castle, which is the former residence of Cyrus the Great. And it was also here that Darius I found the scrolls of Cyrus authorizing the Jews to return to Jerusalem and rebuild their temple. So there are some significant events. That city still exists today. There's another city called Parsagada, or Parsagada. I'm not sure how you would pronounce it. Spelled like this. And that would be spelled P-A-R-S-A-G-A-D-A. Parsagada, and the significant thing here is that Cyrus built a royal residence here. He also built a capital here. He built a palace here. And he actually built it on the very spot in which he gained a real decisive victory over the Medes. Remember, we talked about Persia started off battling and contesting with the nation of Media to try to get power. Well, the decisive spot where he achieved victory over them is exactly where he put his palace. And there have been two inscriptions found there that confirm Cyrus as king. So the Bible's not the only reference that talks about Cyrus. These inscriptions do as well. Then there's a third city called Persepolis. The city of Persepolis. And that's spelled P-E-R-S-E-P-O-L-I-S, Persepolis. And Darius moved the capital here, where he built his palace fortress, and there was a very, very impressive palace fortress here. The whole city was very well defended with walls and towers. There are a number of beautiful reliefs in the walls and inscriptions that remain today that show Darius as a very powerful king. Beautiful, beautiful artwork done on the walls. One section of reliefs show envoys of 23 different subject nations bringing New Year's gifts to the Persian emperor. So the real significant thing is the fact that this huge fortress was built here. Yes.
Was that
Darius?
Cyrus.
Darius. Mm-hmm. Persepolis.
Cyrus did Parthenia.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then there's one final one called the city of Susa.
I don't really expect you to know too much about these cities. I'm just writing them down because they are the prominent cities. The city of Susa or Shushan. Susa or Shushan.
Susa is spelled S-U-S-A, and it's also known as Shushan in the Bible. It's talked about several times in the scriptures. Shushan is spelled S-H-U-S-H-A-N in the Bible. The name means lily. And the reason why is because there are a number of lilies that grew in this area, vast lily fields. It's famous in the Bible because it was one of the capitals of the Persian Empire. It was also a winter residence of the Persian kings. Many of the Persian kings lived here in the wintertime. This is also the place where there was a palace built that was maintained by Darius I, and also not only Darius I, but Xerxes I. Now, you can read about that in the following scriptures, and I'll list them for you here. You can read about this in Nehemiah chapter 1 and verse 1. It will give you the names of those kings. But Nehemiah chapter 1, verse 1, Esther chapter 2 and verse 8, Esther 2, 8, and Esther chapter 3 and verse 15. Esther chapter 3, verse 15. Now, I'm not sure if you remember or not, but Xerxes was the king that was connected with who? Does anyone remember? Who in the Bible was connected with him? Yeah.
Esther,
right. Esther was married to him. And they've actually found the very palace that Esther lived in, where Queen Esther lived in. Beautiful thing. It covered originally 2.5 acres alone, just the palace did. Included a beautiful throne room. And in the throne room, it was decorated with 36 columns. And each one of these columns was 67 feet high. And that's tall for a column. You know, and of course, your ceiling is built on top of that. That's like almost two telephone poles on top of each other, see, with a ceiling over that. The interior of the room was decorated with colored glazed bricks, and they were arranged in the form of rosettes and lions and men and other attractive patterns. So very, very beautiful palace that she lived in. Okay, well, then the final point on Persia is this. Let's talk briefly about their religion, just real briefly. They had a different god than the Babylonians and the Assyrians had. They had a god whose name was Ahura Mazda. Not sure if that's where the car came from or not. They had a chariot that was called a Mazda, or Ahura Mazda. That's spelled A-H-U-R-A-M-A-Z-D-A. Ahura Mazda. And what this name means is the wise Lord. The wise Lord. So this is one of their gods. Actually, they had several gods, but they had official priests that ministered to Ahura Mazda. They were called the magicians. A lot of the occult, a lot of sorcery, a lot of Zoroastrianism, and a lot of the zodiac and star worship and all of that has sprung directly from Persian worship. But what they believed is that Ahura Mazda granted the king the right to rule. And they believed also that the king was the very image of the god. That is, the king, in a sense, was almost Ahura Mazda himself. Now, in their theology, they made a little bit of a distinction between that. But as far as the people were concerned, they actually pretty much worshipped their rulers as Ahura Mazda. But officially, their theology said that he was the image of their god. They also believed in a number of nature gods, such as air and water and the heaven and the earth, and the sun, and the moon, and so forth. So they worshiped those things as well, and although they did not worship them in temples. And the way they would worship is they would go out in fields, and they would sacrifice animals in open fields, and they would do it in the presence of a chanting magician priest. And he would stand out there, and he would chant, and they would offer these sacrifices onto the moon, and onto the star, and onto the suns, and onto Ahura Mazda. Well, in the middle of the 6th century B.C., 600 years before the time of Christ, there was a man called Zarathustra. And he was an actual man that lived during that time. He was a reformer, actually, is what he was. But his name is spelled like this, Zarathustra. And he's also known as Zoroaster. He's known by both of these names. Called both of those things historically. Zarathustra is spelled Z-A-R-A-T-H-U-S-T-R-A, also known as Zoroaster, Z-O-R-O-A-S-T-E-R. And what he developed was a new religious system called Zoroastrianism. I'm not sure if you've ever heard of that, but Zoroastrianism. And it's just basically taken from the name Zoroaster, and you add ism pretty much to the end of that name. But the basic tenets of it are like this, and I'll mention them just real briefly here. In Zoroastrianism, what they did, first of all, they recognized Ahura Mazda as the only chief god. So they did away with all the other nature gods, the gods of heaven and the gods of the sun and the god of the moon. They did away with all of them. And they had only one god called Ahura Mazda. And Ahura Mazda was in this eternal conflict with another evil spirit, and this other evil spirit's name was Engra Mainyu. I know it's real hard with all of these names, but the point is that there was this one good god called Ahura Mazda, and there was another evil spirit called Engra Mainyu. And these things were in constant conflict with each other. And so there was the good god, and there was a bad god. Now what this did, it brought in a doctrine called dualism, in which there were almost double gods, two gods, and they were locked in mutual conflict with each other. And it kind of carried over into some other oriental religions. Maybe you've heard the thing of like the yin and the yang and these various things. You know, there's the good and the bad, and there's this and that that can happen to your life. Well, it kind of has that idea to it. And then Zarathustra also opposed sacrifices and offerings of drink to the various other gods. He didn't claim that they existed. And basically, they worshipped Ahura Mazda by perpetual fire. They would build fires, and that was an offering onto this Ahura Mazda. And Zoroaster, or Zarathustra, actually worshipped this god Ahura Mazda himself, and he was this great reformer. Okay, with that, we close our section on Persia. Any questions on Persia? On the kingdom of Persia? The next one we're going to talk about is Egypt, but we're not going to talk about it right now. We're going to talk about a few Bible customs first. Yes.
So, at the time of Christ, were those quote wise men, unquote, that came to visit the Jewish, were they Zoroaster?
Okay, the Magi? Well, the Magi are a little bit of an enigma, exactly who they are. Most scholars say that they probably came from the Babylonian area in which the Jews had once lived. And they were scholars that studied the stars and the sky and so forth. And they probably, or very possibly even, were Jews that had lived in that area and were aware of the scriptures and knew that there were 70 weeks that were going to transpire before Messiah would come. And they were mathematicians, and they were able to discern the approximate time of Messiah. And then, of course, the star was a further sign to them. So I think it's a little bit of an enigma exactly who they were, but I don't think that they were just rank pagans that worshiped pagan gods, because, see, they were searching for the true God. They were searching for Messiah. And when they came, they bowed down and they worshiped him. And so evidently they did worship the true God of heaven. So it would be my opinion that they were probably believers in Yahweh. But they lived in a culture in which they knew a lot about the stars and so forth. Well, let's move on to a Bible custom now. Let's talk about a typical day in Bible times. What would it be like to have a typical day in Bible times? A little bit different than the way we live nowadays, obviously. Let's go through and outline a number of things. Maybe you've wondered what would go on in a typical day, just in the typical household there in Bible times. Well, one of the things that you'd notice as the day started is the fact that everyone gets up very, very early. They get up very, very early. Common custom there. Freeman notes in his book, Manner and Customs of the Bible, as follows, quote, "The habit of early rising is all but universal in Palestine. The climate makes this a necessity for the greater part of the year, the heat being so great that hard labor is oppressive a few hours after sunrise. At early dawn, laborers go to their work, and travelers start on their journeys," end quote. And so because of the oppressive heat, they've got to get up very early. They've got to get started on their details so that they can take their afternoon siesta, which is normally what they do. And then they'll work after their afternoon nap a little bit later on in the day. But there's a number of scriptures that talk about this, and I'll mention some of them for you. Genesis chapter 22, verse 3 talks about this. Exodus chapter 34. Verse 4 talks about early rising. Job chapter 1, verse 5 talks about it. Mark chapter 1, verse 35 talks about this. And also Luke chapter 21, verse 38. Jesus very customarily arose very early, got up and went out in the mountains and prayed and waited on the Lord. Now, one of the first sounds that you would hear if you were to walk down the average street of a village would be the grinding of grain by the women. The grinding of grain by the women. Now, normally that's the first sound that would greet your ears as you would leave your house in the morning. And the women would be out there grinding the grain for the day. Real, real tedious task as well. Now, the women are the ones that engage primarily in that task. The men don't do it. It was not considered to be a man's job. So it was pretty much the women that did it, and they began very early in the morning to do that. It often required half the day just to complete that task. So, you know, you're talking about probably maybe 6 to 8 hours would be half of their day. And they just spend that grinding the grain. Real exciting day, huh, to get up and get out and grind your grain. It's something that they were very involved in. Now, it wasn't particularly a pleasant sound to hear when you take two stones and rub them together in every single house that's going on. But it was really music to their ears, and I'll tell you why. They at least had food to grind. See, they lived from day to day. They didn't live like we live. They went out and they purchased enough grain for that day. And so that meant that they had food to eat. It was a sign of blessing. It was a sign of plenty. And so really, it was taken as a sign of blessing. In fact, the Bible talks about that it's a sign of judgment. It's a sign of God's curse on the people when the grinding of the millstones are not heard. You can read about that in Jeremiah chapter 25 and verse 10. Jeremiah chapter 25, verse 10. Now, one thing you'd never see a man grinding grain. That would be beneath their dignity. That'd be kind of like a man walking around with a dress on in America today. You know, well, you might see that if you went to the right place or the wrong place, however you might want to take that. But, you know, it's beneath a man's dignity. I wouldn't be caught dead in a thing. You know, a Scottish kilt or anything like that, no way in the world. You'd have to hog tie me and put it on me. I'd never have it on. Well, that's the way a man would be with grinding the grain. He'd never be caught dead grinding grain. So often what would happen is that an enemy would come down and oppress the Israelites, and the enemy would take the men and make them grind grain. And it was a humiliating thing because there would be the men out grinding the grain. And this happened to Samson. Powerful Samson was put to the grindstone, grinding grain. That's found in Judges chapter 16, verse 21. Judges 16, 21. Also, the Babylonians did the same thing. They took the Jews back to Babylon, and there they are. The young men are back there grinding grain. Now, that's even more of a slap in the face. Young, muscular men, which normally are used to farm work or, you know, work in the vineyards, and here they are grinding the grain, which was a woman's job. And that's seen in Lamentations chapter 5, verse 13. Lamentations chapter 5, verse 13. Now, there are a lot of different handmills that they had. They had a little simple handmill, like a mortar and a pestle. Or how do you call it? Is that right? Did I pronounce that right? Where it's a little bowl like that made out of stone, and there's a little stone hammer, as it were, and they put the grain in there and they beat it like that if they just need a little bit of grain. So they had something like that. But typically what they had was a system with two stones called millstones. And it consisted of two circular slabs of rock, like the above diagram here. They had these two slabs of rock, and the top slab fit on the bottom slab like that. The top slab was a circular rock. It was about 20 to 24 inches in diameter and about 4 inches thick. So it was fairly thick. And then the bottom millstone was even a little bit thicker. And these millstones were very, very valuable, very expensive. You can imagine back during that time, where are you going to find rocks like that? You know, you've got to have a mason or you've got to have someone make them for you. And often they had these millstones. They had them for years. And something that would be very grave is if someone stole your millstones. I mean, this was the microwave of the day. It was the washing machine of the day. It was something that was very, very valuable, a millstone. In fact, God warned the Israelites, and he said, now, when someone is really poor and they owe you money, don't take their millstones from them because they need those to grind their grain. They'd have to eat their wheat whole. And if you've ever eaten wheat whole, it's hard to eat that way. And so they needed it to grind their grain. And what would happen is that the upper stone would fit on the bottom stone, and they had a little wooden handle on the top stone. They also had a little wooden column in the middle stone here. And this hole right here was funnel-shaped.
and they would put it on top of the bottom stone, and they would pour the grain in the middle hole, and they would just rotate the stone like that, and the grain would work its way out in between the two stones. And they would put this thing on a sheepskin, and they would stand there all day or sit there all day. And normally what they did, they had two women, and the women would face each other. And this was a very tiring, very tedious job. And what you'd do, you'd pull the stone towards you, and then the other woman would pull it the other way, and they'd work like this in a circular motion. And they'd work together like this, and of course it was convenient for them. They could chat. They had hours to talk, boring job anyway, and they could talk about the latest gossip and the latest affairs of the day. You can read about that in Matthew chapter 24 in verse 41. Matthew chapter 24, verse 41. And then, of course, after the grain came out, they still weren't done because they had this pile of grain on the sheepskin, and then they had to sift it very carefully, and they'd have to remove these little bits of rock that would often get in it from the millstone. Otherwise, you'd be eating your bread, and you'd bite down, and a little piece of rock in there. And, you know, have you ever had dirt in your food? There's nothing more aggravating than dirt in your food. When you bite down and you hear this crunching sound, it just... I don't even want to eat the rest of the food on my plate when something like that happens. But you've got to be more of a pioneer if you're going to be an Israelite during this time. No. And then as far as the time of the meals, they basically only had two meals. They probably would have had three if they had more food, but they didn't have that much food back then. And they had two meals a day. They had breakfast and dinner. And breakfast could actually be any time in the morning up to almost noon. All the way from early morning up to the time of noon. Normally, it just kind of depended on what time, you know, the father had to go out and work. They kind of arranged it around his schedule, but it could be at any time up to noon. And then the evening meal was normally eaten when the father came back from his work, whatever time that was, probably when the sun set, see? And when he came back, that's when the evening meal was. And normally, the major meal and the main meal was the evening meal, although not always. Normally, that was the largest meal that they ate. And just kind of depended on the nature and the place of the man's work as far as when they ate. Now, another task that the women had to do, and you'll see that women, they had a hard life back then. They had a lot to do. There's a lot of work for them. In fact, really what it boils down to is when you study a lot about Bible life, often it was the men that did more socializing than the women did. Often the women had a lot more domestic duties to do, and meanwhile the men would be down yakking at the city gate, talking with all the strangers that came in through the city gate. So often the picture's kind of reversed as far as the way it is today. Although a lot of women certainly have enough to do today as well. But another detail that the women would do is the weaving of cloth. They'd have to weave cloth and they'd have to make clothes. They didn't go out and buy their clothes. They made all their clothes. And so involved in that is that the Jewish women, they were responsible for making the clothing of the family. Now, the one consolation is that normally you had the clothes on you, and that was pretty much it. You didn't have like a whole wardrobe, unless you were wealthy, but you didn't have a lot of clothes. You had the clothes on you and maybe a spare tunic, and maybe often just a mantle over you, and that was pretty much it because of their poverty. And normally they were made out of wool. Normally most of their garments were made out of wool, which came from their flocks, and they would spin the wool into yarn, and they would do that with spinning wheels and so forth. Often they had little hand, I'm not sure what they called them, distaffs or something like that, that they would spin the wool, and they would make thread out of that. And once the yarn was spun, they used a very primitive loom, and they would use that to weave the garments, and it was a very slow, very tedious process. Especially, I imagine, if you had like five boys, you know, and they're always out playing and roughhousing and everything, and so you're keeping up with that on top of it all. Well, another job for the women, washing clothes. And they didn't have Maytags. They didn't have their washing machine. They didn't throw things in the washing machine and come back and check on it in a half hour. Normally what they did, they just dipped the clothes in water repeatedly. And then they would beat them with a stick, probably, you know, real vigorously or something. Take out all their frustrations on their clothes or something, but they would beat their clothes with a stick. They did have a soap-like substance that they made out of certain types of vegetables. I can't give you the name of the vegetables, but they were able to make this soap, and they did have a soap. They would mix it in with the clothes, and they would beat the clothes then with their stick. And often they would even take the clothes down and wash them in a stream if a stream was available. But more often than not, you lived in a village which just had one central well, maybe. That was the only well in town,
and so they would wash them in big tubs or big clay pots or something like this. Two scriptures that talk about washing. One is found in Jeremiah chapter 2 and verse 22. And in Jeremiah 2:22, here's what it says. For though thou wash thee with nitre and take thee much soap, yet thine iniquity is marked before me, saith the Lord God. Talking about the state of Israel. Then Malachi chapter 3, verse 2. And in Malachi 3:2 it says, But who may abide the day of his coming, and who shall stand when he appeareth? For he is like a refiner's fire and like fuller's soap. That was a special type of soap that made garments very clean and very white. And then finally, Psalm chapter 51, verse 2. David used the very word that the Jews used for washing clothes and for beating clothes. Here's what he said. Psalm 51, verse 2. David said, Wash me thoroughly from mine iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. He's actually using a laundry term there. He's actually saying, Lord, put me in the washing machine. Lord, cleanse me. I am defiled. I am dirty. One author writes this about this word employed by David. He said that, quote, the word is significant in that it probably means washing by kneading or beating, not by simple rinsing. The psalmist is ready to submit to any painful discipline, if only he may be cleansed. Wash me, beat me, tread me down, hammer me with malice, dash me against the stones. Do anything with me, Lord, if only these foul stains are melted from the texture of my soul. So David is really vivid there. He's saying, Lord, I need to be cleansed by your Spirit, and you do whatever you need to do. Well, then here's another job. If you happen to be one of the young girls in the family, here's what you got stuck with for the day. It would be your job to care for the goats, and you'd care for the goats. And normally, goats are pretty easy to take care of. We had a number of them when I grew up on. I lived on a farm, and we had several goats. And normally, you don't have to do a whole lot with goats except show them where to eat and then lead them to the watering hole. Well, that was the task that was assigned to the young women. However, there was one great difficulty that they had, and that was this. There came the time for the annual or the daily watering of the goats, and so you take your goats down to the watering hole. But the thing about the watering hole is that often there were camel herds there. And when the camel herds were there, and you would come in with your goats, the goats couldn't get in because the camels were there. And the camels could go out for days without water. And so when they came in, they would drink, it seemed like nonstop. And they would drink, and they would drink, and they would drink, and they would drink. And furthermore, if you were a young girl, you were kind of just pushed out of the way. And you'd have to wait until the camel herds left and so forth. And that was kind of a headache, kind of a trialsome thing for them to go through. That's talked about back in Exodus chapter 2 and verse 15. I really never saw what a goat was much good for. We never milked our goats. That all they did is get into trouble. Exodus chapter 2, verse 15 says this. In fact, our goats used to jump over the fence all the time and climb up on the cars and climb up. And a lot of people sure got mad at them because the pickup would be parked there and they'd come out and the goat would be on top of it. And they just love high places. If they can find any high place, they'll always find the highest place they can. Even when a little baby goat is born, we had little baby goats and they'd get born and they'd jump on their mother's back and they'd stand on their mother's back there. Just kind of their nature. Exodus chapter 2, verse 15. It says, Now when Pharaoh heard this thing, he sought to slay Moses. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian. And he sat down by a well. Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. And the shepherds came and drove them away. But Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. When they came to Reuel, their father, he said, How is it that you are come so soon today? How is it that you're done watering the goats and watering the sheep so soon? And they said in verse 19, An Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds and also drew water enough for us and watered the flock. So that was a real blessing to them. Normally there's a lot of competition, see, and you wanted to get there to the watering hole when no one else was around. Well, then there came another event in the day, and that was the midday siesta. Everyone shut their business down for a period of time. And the time of the greatest heat in Palestine is from noon to 3 p.m., and it can get hot in Palestine. I mean, we're talking about, you know, 105 degrees or 110 degrees. It can get very, very hot. Down by the Dead Sea, it's been known to get like 120 degrees down in that area. So with that tremendous heat, they normally would just simply stop their activity and take a nap. And they'd lay down, they'd find a shady spot in a vineyard or behind some rock or underneath a tree, and all the little bazaars and everything in the towns, they'd just shut up shop and everyone would take a nap, just take a little siesta. And if you were a shepherd, you'd lead your flock to some cool and shady spot, and there you'd let them recline and rest up. That's probably what Abraham is doing in Genesis chapter 18, verse 1. Abraham is sitting in the tent door in the heat of the day, probably taking his siesta there. Genesis chapter 18, verse 1. Now, another thing you would notice as you were walking about and kind of observing things during the day, you'd notice the conversation of the people. They speak a little bit differently than the way we speak. They make constant reference to the name of God in their conversation. They're constantly alluding to God. If they're astonished, they might cry out, "Look what God has wrought." Or if they were asked to do a certain thing, invariably they'll say, "If God wills." They always include that phrase, "if God wills." They had more of an idea of the sovereignty of God in their outlook on life. So you would ask them to do something for them, they would say, "Well, if God wills." When a farmer would greet his workers, he often would say to them, "God be with you." And they would exchange the greeting. They would say, "And God be with you, and God bless you." And very often you'd hear the term, "Blessed be the Lord." So God is often referred to in their language. Now, also you would notice that they exaggerate a lot, and that's very customary. And they don't look at it necessarily as lying like we do, but they exaggerate. And they make their language real vivid, real strong. They speak in hyperboles a lot. Jesus did this, but they'll often say things like, "What I say to you is the truth, and if it is not, I will cut off my right arm." They'll say things like that all the time. And they'll make it real, real strong. And like Jesus talked about all these various things, he talked about it's easier, you know, for a camel to go through an eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter into the kingdom of God. It's a hyperbole. He talked about, you know, if you're going to judge someone, then first take the beam out of your own eye, the timber out of your own eye, and then take the mote or the speck of sawdust out of your brother's eye. And all these exaggerations were used by them very, very, very consistently. Jesus talked about that if your right eye offends you, then pluck it out, cast it from you. If your right hand offends you, cut it off, cast it from you. And that was just the way they would speak. Now, also, you would notice when you listen to their language that they would use very beautiful imagery. They often had a touch of a poet about them. They would use these various flowery phrases, and they would often speak in proverbs. When you read the book of Job is filled with proverbs, and it's given in poetical nature. That's the way they would talk. They would talk in poetry often and talk in proverbs, and they would use these flowery pictures. And a good example of this is Isaiah chapter 55, just to kind of illustrate how they would often speak so picturesquely. Isaiah chapter 55, and it says down here in verses 10 through 13, it says this: "For as the rain cometh down as the snow from heaven, and returneth not thither, but watereth the earth, and make it bring forth in bud, that it may give seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so shall my word be that goeth forth out of my mouth." Then look at verse 12. "For you shall go out with joy and be led forth with peace, and the mountains and the hills shall break forth before you in a singing, and all the trees of the field shall clap their hands. And instead of the thorn shall come up the fir tree, and instead of the briar shall come up the myrtle tree." See how picturesque that is? The mountains and the hills clapping their hands, and all the trees rejoicing and everything. That's how they would speak. And often you would notice, too, as you were to listen in on the conversations, you'd find that they deal with very, very delicate subjects, but they'll do it without any shame. And they'll do it in open company. They'll do it with little children there. They'll talk about things that would make us very squeamish, that would make us very embarrassed. And in fact, even now, when visitors go to Palestine, many times they're embarrassed by the conversations that they talk about. It's kind of like if you grow up on a farm. If you grow up on a farm, a lot of things happen on a farm, and farmers talk about these things, and to a city slicker, they're embarrassing. You know, they talk about them because these things happen. Those of you that have lived on a farm, you know what I'm talking about. And they happen all the time. And to a farmer, you know, no big thing. It's just part of life. And, of course, the Orientals, they were much closer to nature, and they would talk about, you know, childbirth and the birth of a child and all these type of things. They would just speak about them openly, and no one would think twice about it. So we would be very embarrassed by some of the things that they would talk about. Well, let's talk about another thing that the woman would have to do. Later on, we'll talk about the men in another topic. But another thing that the women would have to do is to go get water for the household. Now, that wasn't an easy job to get household water. Several gallons were needed for every day. Normally, they had to walk a fair amount of distance to the nearest well or spring. And so normally what they had was a large earthenware vessel, a large clay vessel. And they had an uncanny ability. They'd take a little towel-like thing, and they'd wrap it up real tight, and they would roll it up into a flat little pad. They'd put that on their head, and they'd put this clay vessel right on their head, and they could walk with that thing. Now, that's amazing. It's, you know, to be able to walk with this large earthenware vessel right on their head. And that's how they would carry their water, and they'd fill that thing up. They might have 5 gallons of water in that thing, and they'd put that on their head, and they'd walk all the way back home again. Now, if you've ever lifted a 5 gallon bucket of water, that's heavy. That's heavy. That, I don't know what it would weigh, maybe 30 pounds, 35 pounds.
8 pounds per gallon.
So 40 pounds then, eh? So 40 pounds on their head, and that's a lot of weight. And they'd walk with that thing home, and they'd do it without spilling it. You'd never see a man fetching water. That's a woman's job again. And that's why Jesus gave this sign in Mark chapter 14 and in verse 13. Mark 14:13. It seems kind of obscure to us, but Jesus said, talking to the disciples, said, in preparation for the Last Supper there, Christ said, go in and hire an upper room. Go into the city of Jerusalem, which, you know, a couple hundred thousand people live in that town. And how are they going to know where the man is? How are they going to? Jesus didn't give them a name. He didn't give them an address or anything. Jesus just said, go into the city and follow the man that's carrying water, the pitcher of water. And find him, and wherever he goes, just follow him. He'll lead you to the place. That would have been real conspicuous to them. They would have walked into the city, and men didn't carry water. So they would have walked in, and there was a man carrying water on his head or whatever, carrying this pitcher of water, and they knew instantly that's the man right there, and they followed him, and they were led right to this house, and then they rented the house. Now, if they needed a larger supply of water, like a lot of water, let's say maybe, you know, 50 gallons of water or whatever, then what they would do, the men would do this. They would take an animal skin, like the skin of maybe a goat or the skin of maybe a cow, and when they butchered the cow, they would cut that skin off, and they'd take the whole skin off in one piece. And then they would sew it up. In fact, they did have a way in which they could get the whole skin off without even cutting it, as far as cutting it in half, see. But they'd take the skin off, and they'd sew the legs up, and they would fill that thing with water, and it became like a water bag, and it wouldn't leak either. So they'd fill it up with water. Of course, it was quite heavy, and they'd fill that thing with water, and they would use that as well. It was also very customary if you were in one of these towns, there were people that were out selling water on the streets. They were water vendors. And they would have an animal skin, and it'd be strapped across their back, and they'd go out and they'd sell water just like Pepsi's. And because water was so rare, you didn't have a tap. You didn't go up to, you know, a spigot and get water. And so you'd buy water like that. Of course, today it's replaced with pop. And normally what they sell today is either Coca-Cola or Pepsi. And they don't call it Pepsi. They call it Bepsi. And they'll ask you if you want some Pepsi. And they walk around, and they got, just like at maybe a ball game or something, they've got this tray, and they walk around, and they sell Pepsi on the streets, and they're calling out. And it's amazing where you can find them. I talked to one sister that was in Palestine. She was way down in this area. It's called the city of Petra. And it's way, way back in the mountains. You've got to go several mountains through this little narrow Wadi Qumran, or not Wadi Qumran, but a little narrow ravine called a Wadi. They go way back in there, and back in there it opens up into a large cavern, and there's a city way back in there. And they were way back in there, and they had climbed back in amongst all these ruins, and they were way back in near a beautiful flowing stream there, and they were sitting there. No one was around. They sat for quite a while, and here over the mountain and down the other side came this Arab with his little tray of Pepsis and asked them if they wanted to buy a Pepsi. Came from nowhere, from nowhere. So they've kind of, you know, modernized a little bit. And that's good for the dentist. Gives them a little bit of money, though, over there. Pop is rotten for your teeth if you don't know that. So I'm told. Well, then another thing that they would do, not only gather water, but They would also have to care for their bodies, obviously. They didn't have deodorant. They didn't have all the readily available perfumes like we have today. And because it's so hot over there, body odor is a real problem, obviously. They're sweating, and normally they've got like two or three garments on made out of wool on top of that that they're putting on. And the heat, you know how wool is the way it is. And the heat is maybe 105 degrees out. And so body odor is a real problem, so they would have to wash fairly frequently, and they did do that. They would take baths with some degree of regularity. Now, normally what they would do is this. Normally they would wash at the end of the day, and they would have like wash basins, and they would just kind of give themselves just, what do they call it? What is that? A little sponge bath is what they would do for most of them, because they didn't have a large bath to get into. So they would wash their bodies. In fact, the law of Moses commanded bathing, actually commanded them to bathe themselves. And it was a sign not only of physical cleanliness, but it was also a spiritual cleansing that occurred there too. God wanted them to keep their bodies clean. The Bible talks about, well, not the Bible, but there's an old proverb that says, cleanliness is next to godliness. I think it was Wesley that said that. And there is a spiritual truth that if you're walking before God, it's good to keep your body clean, especially if you've got to work or be around other people. And talks about this in Genesis chapter 35 and verse 2. Genesis 35, verse 2. Jacob, talking to his household, told them to put away the strange gods that are among you and be clean and change your garments. See, commanding them to wash themselves.
Is the custom among the Jews or the Arabs? The reason I ask you is because I heard of and first I knew a situation where I don't know if the people bathe themselves frequently, but their clothes they didn't wash frequently. Which...
Well, I think probably that is true. Our standard of cleanliness is a lot different than theirs over there. We're used to a much, much higher standard of cleanliness. And so what is clean to them would be repulsive to us. And I'm sure even amongst the Jews, they did not have near the standards of cleanliness. As far as their garments, a lot of them only had a few garments. And it was such a hard job to wash them and everything. I'm sure that they weren't constantly being washed, and they were a lot dirtier, I'm sure, than ours are today. And they didn't have showers and so forth. Although, Isaiah 44 and verse 3 is interesting. It says in Isaiah 44, verse 3, I will pour waters upon him that is thirsty and floods upon the dry ground. What that is really alluding to is one type of bathing they would practice. They would stand there, and their spouse or a friend or whatever would pour water on them. And it was kind of like a hand shower. And they would scrub up, and they would pour more water on them and rinse the dirty stuff off of them. So they did have that type of bath as well. If you were a wealthy homeowner, you often had your own private bathing facilities. This is if you were real wealthy. And that's if you had a courtyard in the back of your house. And you'd have a pool back there, and you could go back there and do it. But if you were poor, well, then you'd have to depend on either sponge bathing or maybe a stream or some other body of water. If you were a Greek or a Roman, they had public baths, and they would go into the public bath. But the Jews never associated with that. That was considered a sin for them, and rightly so. Then after the bath, they would perfume their body with a very fragrant oil. And often, I'll tell you, this thing was pungent, real strong. You could often smell someone coming before you could see them. Because they knew the thing about body odor, and so they would cover themselves, lavish this perfume on them. Like we talked about earlier, they would pour the anointing oil on their head. It was often fragrant. And often the women, they had this little ball of spices. It was like a round, kind of like a pomander or whatever, and it was a round ball of spices, and they would hang it on their necks. And it was real, real odoriferous. It had a real strong odor to it. Well, then also there were hairstyles, and let me say something about that real briefly. The Jews normally cut their hair, as far as the men now, fairly short. And normally they used a very rude pair of scissors or even a razor. They had a razor knife that kind of looked like this with a handle on it. And it was made out of copper. And you could hone it fairly sharp, and they would use that thing to cut their hair. And so the men would keep their hair cut fairly short, although they did not shave their heads bare. God commanded them not to do that. The women, they always wore their hair long. They normally did not cut their hair. Of course, we think of Mary of Bethany, she was able to wipe the feet of Jesus with her hair. Obviously, her hair was very long, enabling her to do that. Paul said in 1 Corinthians chapter 11 that long hair on a man was considered a sin, contrary to nature, contrary to how God designed it. The Bible Almanac, that was 1 Corinthians chapter 11. The Bible Almanac, page 482, says this about hairstyles. Hebrew men considered the hair to be a very important personal ornament, so they gave much care and attention to it. Hebrew men cut their hair much as modern Western men do, using a primitive kind of scissors. When a Jewish man made a religious vow, he did not cut his hair. The Israelites were not to shave their hair so closely that they resembled heathen gods who had shaved heads, end quote. So normally they cut their hair fairly short, very much like a Western man would cut their hair. And a lot of people kind of have the misconcept that Bible men during the time of Jesus had real long flowing hair. They really didn't, though. That, of course, has come about from Rembrandt and Raphael and the other medieval painters that painted hair according to the style of their time. But Palestinian times, during the time of Jesus, the custom was to cut hair fairly short. Another major thing as far as a man's beauty or outward adorning was his beard. Very, very important that he had a beard. Very important. They spent a lot of attention on their beard. They would trim it very carefully. It was a great insult to attempt to touch another man's beard. You'd never want to touch another man's beard. It was considered sacred to him. And so you wouldn't touch that, except if you wanted to pay homage to him or show respect to him, what you'd do, you would stroke it very respectfully. That sounds really strange to us. But instead of shaking hands, they would stroke their friend's beard. Sounds strange, doesn't it? Or they would kiss the beard. They would often kiss the beard. And that was a sign of respect and a sign of affection. So they would meet and they would stroke each other's beards. And you can read about that in 2 Samuel chapter 20, verse 9. Wouldn't you love to go to Palestine? Go back in your time machine about 2,000 years back in time. 2 Samuel chapter 20, verse 9. And then, also, a great, great disgrace was to tear out a man's beard. And at times this happened when someone would want to humiliate someone else, they'd pluck his beard out. And that was a great disgrace for that to happen. Remember that happened to David's men? I can't remember who did it, but there were some mighty men of David, and these other enemies of David plucked out their beard. And they were headed back home again, and they wrote David, and they said, "What should we do? Our beards have been plucked out and everything." And David said, "Well, you just tarry in the city until your beards grow back. You just wait." It was such an embarrassing thing, and because everyone had a beard during that time. And the Bible talks about the beard of Jesus. It was plucked out. That was part of his humiliation. Isaiah chapter 50, verse 6. Isaiah 50, verse 6. Evidently, the Romans, maybe the Jews too, plucked out his beard and pulled it right out, and that was a very humiliating thing, shameful thing, part of the disgrace that he had to endure. And often, if a Hebrew man was mourning or weeping or repenting before God, they'd pluck their beards out. It was a sign of remorse. It was a sign of repentance, and you can see that in Ezra chapter 9, verse 3. Ezra 9, 3. Okay, well, that's it for that Bible custom. Later on, we'll talk about some other connections here with everyday Palestinian Bible life. But for right now, we want to switch back, and we're going to talk about another country. So are there any questions about what we talked about thus far? Yes. They actually pulled it out. Very. Very. Very painful. But that's what they would do. Part of their humiliation. Now, when they trim their beards, they use the razor, and they would trim it like that and cut it real carefully. Well, we're going to go way back in time now, and we're going to talk about the country of Egypt. Remember we talked about the seven so-called world governments, Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Medo-Persia, and so forth? Let's go way back in time, and let's talk about the first one, Egypt. Very fascinating country, Egypt. Has a lot of interesting history. It's important to realize that while civilization was developing in Babylonia under Nimrod and under Hammurabi, it was making actually even greater strides down south in the land of Egypt. The level of culture that they developed down there was phenomenal. It was absolutely incredible. And so the Bible story actually starts in the land of Babylonia, which is the cradle of the human civilization. It very soon after the accounts of Babylonia shifts to Egypt, as an area that plays a major portion in Old Testament history. In fact, Egypt is mentioned over 550 times in the Old Testament alone. So it certainly plays a great part in Bible history. Now, in ancient times, Egypt actually consisted of mainly two areas, Upper and Lower Egypt. Upper and Lower Egypt. And so I'd like to mention briefly the dimensions for these two areas. Find a good map that will show us the land of Egypt here. This one isn't too bad right here. I think we'll use that. First of all, there's Upper Egypt. Upper Egypt is talking about this very narrow stretch of land that follows the Nile River. So this whole stretch right along here that flows down through the heart of the land of Egypt. The Nile River flows down through it. That is called Upper Egypt. It's a narrow strip of land. It's watered by the Nile River. It extends all the way from the city of Cairo south about 450 miles. About 450 miles. It's a long, narrow, fertile valley averaging only about 12 miles in width. So it's 450 miles long, and in the heart of the valley actually only averages 12 miles. That's not a lot of space. That's not a lot of land. Very narrow, very long, and very, very fertile. Now, Lower Egypt is called the Nile Delta. Delta is where the river flows out and meets the ocean. The Nile Delta, and it's a triangular area. It flows into this thing right here. You can kind of see it. It looks like a triangle. So the Nile River splits up into all these different little rivers. It flows into the Mediterranean Sea. Let me give you the dimensions for the Nile Delta. It measures about 125 miles north to south, 125 miles north to south, and about 115 miles east to west. 115 miles east to west. So really, if you were going to draw the land of Egypt, here's kind of how you would draw it. It's real long and skinny, and right where it flows into the Mediterranean Ocean, down there in Lower Egypt, it kind of spreads out. So we'll make the Mediterranean Ocean right like this. And then Egypt itself kind of looks like this. And so this would be considered Lower Egypt right up here, the Nile River Delta, this portion right here. And then Upper Egypt would be this whole fertile valley that flows down like this, very narrow stretch, 450 miles in length. So that didn't give them a lot of land, really. In fact, when you really figure it out, comprises an area of less than 13,000 square miles. Not very much land at all, 13,000 square miles. So the total length of Egypt from start to finish is only about 550 miles in length. And as soon as you leave this, it's just barren desert. Absolutely no sign of life. The only sign of life is along the Nile River itself. As far as the climate in Egypt, it had a very beautiful climate there, still does. Temperature ranges from about maybe 52 degrees in the wintertime to about 80 degrees in the summertime, although it will get a lot hotter than that. We're talking about average temperatures here, so it can get a lot hotter than that, and I suppose could even get cooler than that. But average is about 52 degrees in the winter to 80 degrees in the summertime. The air is very, very dry. There's very little rainfall that falls in this area, which means that most of the country is dry. Most of the country outside of the river itself is very dry. So here's how you could summarize their climate. Very temperate and very dry. Very temperate and very dry. And that really was a real blessing to them. They were able to get all the water that they needed from irrigation from the River Nile. And we're going to see the Nile River played a great part in their history. Helped actually advance their culture light years ahead almost beyond other cultures, because of some real key connections. Well, the significant thing about this dry, temperate climate is this, is that archaeological remains remain longer here than any other spot in the ancient world, really. They found people buried in the sands that had been buried there for thousands of years, still perfectly preserved, as it were. Mummies found and all kinds of things because of that dry, temperate climate. No, very little humidity in that area. Okay, well, we'll have to leave our topic here. We'll talk about Egypt tomorrow. Fascinating culture. Thank you, Brother Lee. Appreciate all your help. Thank you. How are you doing? How are you feeling?
Well, I'm not very good still. Because I got the wrong kind of medicine, and the sound didn't work on me, so I've had stuff throat now for several weeks without having any.
Okay.
Finally, I went back to the doctor and got some good medicine.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Well,